Now that Take Two appears...
Have we started? I'm going to turn my phone off so it doesn't ring. And you...
Oh, it's quite entertaining when you when your phone rings. Someone calls
Yes, woman texting.
Yes, now that Take Two arrives at the same time,
mm-hmm.
do you think that people jump straight from one to the other because they love this? They love
they can't
the
get enough.
So
they can't
much.
Get enough.
They get to the end of Take One and go, I need Take Two immediately.
Yes.
Or do you think they keep us for pudding? You know, you put it just to one side.
Is this a little bit like John Shuttleworth's I Can't Go Back to Savory Now?
Well, maybe, but maybe Take One is the savory, and this is now the dessert.
This is the dessert.
We're the special.
What's the weird? So in other cultures they have weird interstitial courses. I've always thought it was bizarre that
interstitial courses.
Yes,
I've never heard them called that before.
Yes, so they'll be like you know like an amuse-bouche.
Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah.
Yeah, and then a starter, and then something else, and then entree, which actually means main course. But entree shouldn't mean main course. Entree should mean starter.
I don't know, really.
But you know, if you go to a restaurant and they're writing in French, you know, if it's a French restaurant.
Usually.
Yeah, that they use entree. And I always look at it and think entree, that means starter.
I think you just have to look at the price. If it says,
if it's over 40 quid.
If it says £15.25, it's not a starter.
That's not true.
That's the main course.
Nowadays, that's not necessarily true.
Right?
Yeah, nowadays, you know, we were in Norway. If it said £15.25, it was an amuse-bouche.
Yeah.
The prices in Norway, it was...
Really?
Yeah.
Well, Scandi is quite like that anyway.
Yeah. When we first arrived there, we went to the most northerly burger... I told you this, most northerly Burger King in the world. Because Burger King does a vegan thing and we just needed to get some food into Child 2. And we knew that it was Burger King, we could get vegan because they are a very meaty, fishy, culture. So we went to Burger
King. You mean Norway as opposed to Burger King?
Yes, exactly. Well, yes. Burger King, I think, probably as well, although Burger King do have this vegan range, as do, Thingy Bobs. Anyway, I prevented myself from...
McDonald's.
Yeah. Anyway.
Is that like a rude word?
Anyway.
Can you not bring yourself to say it?
It's...
Old,
yeah, no, McDonald, yeah, that's fine, but that's just in our family. That's not the word that we use.
What, do you use a different word?
Yes,
beginning with M.
Yes,
old. Okay.
You just have to bleep it. We call them like everybody else of our age. They go, you know.
I've never heard that before.
You've never heard Mc.
No.
Okay, fine. Well, anyway. Never mind. So we went in and we had the three vegan burgers and chips, and it came to the equivalent of 55 English pounds.
Yeah.
And it was like, wow.
Icelandic pizzas are £25 each.
Precisely so.
Every single option. It's not
thank
that
you.
You're 25. That
thank,
thank
you, Hannah,
was
for bringing me a
Hannah,
coffee. Thank
who
you.
Works
say hello,
on the
Hannah.
Show.
Horse racing correspondent.
Horse racing correspondent, absolutely. But also bringing you coffee.
Thank you.
Because you said thank you halfway through. That. Yeah, so it doesn't matter. It's not just, with all the toppings, 25
No,
quid.
That's just
it's
the base.
Margarita,
that's
25
what, That's
quid.
What Child 3, if Child 3 ordered his pizza of choice, which was pizza with cheese.
Yes.
Or, as everyone else knows it, cheese on toast.
It's probably gone up more. But when we were in Iceland before, as a, four of us.
Eye-watering.
You know, and then five of us. You go for a family pizza meal, mm-hmm. £125.
Yeah, precisely.
And that's drinking tap water. £125.
Whereas yesterday, Dave Norris and I were in a popular pizza chain that we always go to. It's like 40 quid. Eat and drink all you want. Thank you very much.
There's an Icelandic sequence in the Andy Serkis Idris Elba movie,
which I'm watching for next week,
which is called Luther, Fallen Son, I think.
And it's about Luther Vandross, right?
That's right.
Yeah,
it's
good.
All about his career as backing vocalist and
for
then
David
Bowie.
Know,
and then sensational kind of lead man. That would be a very different picture altogether. But the Iceland doubles up as Norway. And I did, and this isn't in the interview, but I said to Andy, Iceland is like a drug, isn't it? You know, once you've gone once, you need to go back. So we just had a little chat all about Iceland. And whenever you see anywhere in a movie or on television that looks as though it's on another planet, It's Iceland. That we should do the show from Iceland.
I'd love to do the show from Iceland, but it would cost so much money.
That is true. Keeping you, you know, like three beers, please. Certainly. That's, that's an entire mortgage.
Yes. Would you like me to arrange the bank loan for you? So would you just like to take the drinks now?
Anyway, it's also one of those countries where you feel dirty buying it because you have to go out of town to a special little concrete hut where a strange person will sell you whatever you want in a brown paper bag for all the money that you possess. Anyway, what should we go and see?
Fashion Reimagined, which is in UK and Irish cinemas today. It's a documentary by Becky Huttner, which follows Amy Pauney, and she won the Vogue Award for Best Young Designer of the Year. She read Naomi Klein's book, No Logo, which was about sweatshops and, you know, corporate greed. And in her words, it completely changed her course. Here is a clip from Fashion Reimagined.
The fashion industry has just raced so fast ahead and so in front of itself that we're all chasing our own tails. I feel like I've lost quite a lot of years of my life running so fast through them.
Who's the latest dresser?
The way the fashion calendar works is you have pre-spring summer collection, spring summer collection, pre-autumn winter collection, autumn winter collection. In big brands, they work to many more, maybe 12. High Street don't even work in seasons. They work on a weekly drop. We produce so many things. 100 billion items of clothing every year, and 3 out of 5 of them end up in landfill.
That statistic, 3 out of 5 garments end up in landfill within a year of purchase, is terrifying. Right. Now, look, I don't know anything about fashion at all. My fashion sense has not moved on since I was a teenager, and you still dress like you're at school. So I don't think either of us. No, we
have a very tasteful cardigan.
Yes, but you don't essentially dress very differently to the way you dress when you wear jeans.
I could go to school in a car. You know, if I went in a cardigan, I'd have been up before the beak.
Up before the beak. But you wear jeans and a t-shirt, and I tend to wear jeans and a t-shirt, and that's it. However, so the subject of the documentary used the money that she had to create a sustainable collection from field to finished garment, is what they call it, transform the entire business. It was at the Mother of Pearl label and, you know, managed to create this line in which everything was traceable. It's really fascinating, firstly, because what you hear is you hear about how she grew up in a caravan because her parents were very eco-conscious and lived off the grid. And she said it was great for them. I'm not entirely sure whether it was great for me. Then when she first talked about sustainability in fashion, apparently everybody just laughed and went, that's not a thing. The difficulty of actually tracing where the material comes from, trying to find out where wool comes from, that even people who are working with wool don't know where it is. The fact that most garments are better traveled than the people that then end up buying them. They've been through 5, 6, 7 countries. The issue of cotton picking and of child labor exploitation, working to make something wearable without leaving a hideous carbon footprint. All these subjects are important. Some time ago, I was talking to somebody about fashion and I said something derogatory. And they said, yeah, it's really annoying the way that men do that. The way that men basically are interested in football and film and all this stuff and then are snotty about fashion basically in a manner that's sexist, because it is a form of art and expression that is not primarily for them. You know, you saw in that clip that we were watching, all the models were women. And it put me in my place, actually. I did think, oh, yeah, no, that's right. I have been snobby. But so I have tried very much to have, I don't know anything about it. And same as I don't know anything about fashion, but I do appreciate that it's a valid and vibrant and thriving form. It is, however, as the documentary makes clear, a form which has an incredible environmental impact. I mean, they start talking about the statistics of what happens with the production chains and what happens in terms of the amount of pollution and the amount of waste and everything. And it does start to make you kind of gasp. The director of the documentary said, "My aim with Fashion Imagined is to bring into sharper focus the story of our clothes, to highlight the people, animals, and resources that go into a garment across complex global supply chains in the hope of fostering a greater appreciation for clothes as items to purchase thoughtfully and cherish." It raises the point which is not, you know, which has been raised elsewhere, which is if you buy a t-shirt in a supermarket for £2, something's gone wrong. because there's no possible way that that T-shirt can have been produced for £2 without it having been done so in a way which you actually don't want to know about. It's exactly. Like, you know, law and sausages, the two things you don't want to see being made. Interesting talking about denim as a very, very, you know, hard-wearing and useful thing, because I know you wear your jeans a lot. And actually, I came out of it thinking, oh, yeah, well, apparently denim does come out of this quite well in certain circumstances, although there are all things to do with supply chains. Anyway, as somebody who's not interested in fashion, I went into the documentary thinking, oh, here we go. And then I was gripped. So it did that thing which I've always said documentaries need to do, which is interest you in a subject that you're not interested in. And it was just kind of quite encouraging to see somebody going, I'm going to try and make this sustainable. And then being hit by obstacle after obstacle after obstacle, just simply trying to track where the wool actually came from, but still plowing on and still doing it. And the clothes look nice. I mean, I don't know, you know, clothes to me look like clothes, but...
I don't think the title helps this.
Fashion Reimagined?
It's a little bit literal. Worthy. Isn't it?
Yes. I think that's true. And I think that probably explains why I went in thinking, okay, I'm not particularly going to enjoy this. But I was much more moved than I thought I was.
Is this cinematic release?
It, as I said, when I did at the very, very beginning, I'll read you out the same thing again, which I just said before. Fashion Reimagined is released in UK and Irish cinemas on the 3rd of March, which is today. It is a 12A certificate film.
That's just interesting that they, because the way the clip... Listen to it, your review, listen to it, you'd think this is a TV documentary.
Yes.
That's what you would naturally imagine.
Yes, but there is, as with it, this is the interesting, I was talking to somebody the other day about this, about the fact that documentaries don't make money cinematically, with very few exceptions. You know, every now and then you'll get a Fahrenheit 9/11 or something, but that's it's very rare. Mostly documentaries do not make money. What they do is they might break even, and then they will have their primary life on streaming service. That is absolutely true. Now, I know there are examples. I know people will write in and say, but industrially, that is generally the thought. So that thing that you're talking about is feeling televisual is because that is where most of us consume documentaries. There is a number of people that go to cinemas to see documentaries, but they are primarily consumed in the home.
So that is Fashion Reimagined. What else have we got? Is anything else that we can
choose to go and see? Yes, The Strays. Can I talk to you about this? Or
take it away.
So The Strays, which is now on Netflix, British horror thriller from actor-turned-director Nathaniel Martello-White, making his directorial feature debut, was topping the UK charts when I clicked on to watch it. Ashley Madikwe is a biracial woman, variously known as Neve or Cheryl. We see her at the beginning of the film, walking away from one life. We then pick her up later on, a few years later. She has completely reinvented herself as a different person. Now she's a posh woman in a posh suburb organizing a posh charity event. And a white friend that she's talking to says, you're practically one of us. She's the deputy head at a posh school where her son is seen talking to a janitor, a young black man who she immediately sees as a potential threat, although you're not entirely sure why. Meanwhile, her daughter befriends a young girl who is similarly seen as an interloper, and all of this causes our anti-heroine to start to crack. The trailer for the film sells it as a kind of mix of The Stepford Wives, you know, the kind of the picket fence, you know, look at this picture, what's wrong with this picture, suburban dream nightmare, and kind of post-Get Out social satire, as I think you can tell from even what I've been setting up there. It's got a brilliant score by Emily Levinas-Farouche, who I love her work. I think she's such an inventive musician. She did Censor, of course, the Prana Bailey Bond film. And the score here really, really kind of gets under the skin of the piece. Great central performance, does a very decent job of keeping us guessing, even when we kind of know underneath what's going on. You know, the way a story can kind of unfold, you sort of know where it's going, but it reveals its information, it sort of parcels it out, you know, bit by bit. I thought it had a properly creepy satirical atmosphere. I personally found it much more effective than Don't Worry, Darling, which of course is a similar thing about, you know, what's wrong with this picture? Here is a vision of the perfect world. And yet, of course, we know it's absolutely not perfect. We know it's all based on something hideous, but we're not just quite sure what that something hideous was, and this is, it's about identity and past and social structures and racism and racial tension and, like I said, you know, class and wealth. But basically, it's one of those films like, do you remember in Nope? Not in Nope, in Us, there was the whole thing about what's going on behind the mask, what's going on behind the veneer. And there was that sort of extended metaphor about the people who lived above ground and the people who lived below ground. And the confrontation is that the people living the good life above ground are confronted with the thing that's happened. You know, it's like the ego in the id. We could read it as a sort of psychological thing. It had a touch of that to it. I thought it was well made, and I found it gripping and entertaining.
Where do I see this?
On Netflix.
Thank you very much.
Called The Strays.
Charlie in California. Greetings, Keanu and Nunu. Keanu back on the show fairly shortly.
Oh, fantastic. When?
For more John Wick. Stay tuned for details. Charlie in California, long-time listener, first-time emailer. Given that I was first alerted by the good doctors to 1979's Caligula.
Yes, new version.
Along with Gore Vidal's
is that what this is about?
Ambitions and producer Bob
Guccione.
More sordid ideas. I thought it my duty to alert you to a pretty radical restoration of the film.
Now, who is this email from?
Charlie in California.
Okay, fine. So is Charlie part of the restoration?
Shall I finish the email?
Yes, sorry. But obviously I'm across this, yeah.
Author and film historian Thomas Nigovan recently posted a video that outlined his involvement in the Caligula Redux, one that touts itself as a reappraisal of Tinto Brass's legendary mess to more closely follow Vidal's original screenplay. Swapping in better performances, takes from old negatives, employing AI and VFX to clean up destroyed audio and swap in more striking vistas, I'll admit to much curiosity reading about this second try at cinema, certainly more positively than the usual doom-laden tech headlines. Would the Good Doctors ever review this updated version of Caligula on the show? And what do you think about artificial intelligence, oh, not that again, and VFX being used in this way on older films? Thanks, says Charlie in California.
Okay, so
over to you.
So Charlie, so obviously I've been across this for a while because this project has been going on for a few years and I've read interviews about it. I was involved in the Channel 4 recutting of Caligula. And what we did quite simply, this was back in 1998, around the turn of the century. We got the longest version, which was the hardcore version with all the Guccione, you know, Penthouse Pet stuff in. And we simply went through it and took out everything that was interstitial put in by Guccione afterwards. Because what happened was, after the film was finished, I mean, everybody fell out with everybody, but after the film was finished, Guccione went back on set to film extra stuff that was then intercut in the movie. I mean, it stands out like a sore thumb. It just doesn't look like it's from the same film. It looks like it's filmed by, you know, by people making interstitial stuff. That's not to say that there isn't stuff that was in the original Tinto Brass version that's very explicit and X-rated, but not in the way that the Guccione stuff was. So we went through, we literally just took the stuff out. We ended up with a version that, you know, it still has many problems, but it was at that point as close as was possible to a version that was Tinto Brass's version. There was then, I think, a TV recut in Italy. And then there's the version in the Caligula Imperial Edition DVD, which is a 3-DVD set, because the shortest version of Caligula is like 79 minutes long and basically just consists of the Penthouse Pets bits, and which is nonsense. It played at the Prince Charles when it opened here in the longest version, which was the version that the BBFC took. There's a lot of history here. Anyway, my own feeling had always been that somewhere in the car crash that is Caligula, there was a very good movie struggling to get out, because I love Malcolm McDowell. I love Helen Mirren. You know, Peter O'Toole, John Gielgud. I know that everyone fell out with everyone and everyone called everyone names and, you know, and everyone kind of, and I interviewed Malcolm McDowell about it once, in which he was just terrifically funny about, you know, how the whole thing ended up. But I have always wondered what Tinto Brass is. I mean, Tinto Brass wasn't above being a total smutmonger. I mean, Tinto Brass's later films like P.O. Box Tinto Brass, they are just soft porn. But he did do some interesting stuff before that. So I am fascinated, genuinely fascinated and keen to see what's happened with Caligula, because I've watched so many versions of Caligula, all of which are basically, no. And I know that I've exasperated people's patience. Jeff Andrew once said to me,
Jeff Andrew
was the film editor at Time Out. He said, your problem, Kermode, is that you think that all art is irredeemable. And I went, your problem is you think that all art is redeemable. Right. What you don't understand is that some art is irredeemable. And he said, and in the case of Tinto brass, always remember, where there's muck, there's brass. And so I would kind of got mocked for thinking that somewhere in this...
And maybe this will prove it to you.
Maybe it will. I mean, I'm fascinated. See, I've seen the video in which they do sort of side by sides of scenes, and they've gone back to Teresa Anne Savoy's original voice recording. As far as the AI stuff is concerned, I have no problem with that at all, because as we know, all film restoration is a kind of artificial process of getting something. If you have a damaged film and you're trying to restore it to what it would have looked like, whether it's taking an old silent film and reproducing the original tinting on it or taking out the grain using digital, I don't see any reason to start getting precious
about... Do enough people care about this film to go and see all this stuff that you're talking about?
Can I tell you a story?
Well, you can answer the question. But do enough people care, do you think?
The weird thing about Caligula is because it's existed in so many versions and was the subject of so much controversy and so much kind of, you know, scandalous stuff, that over the years it probably has made quite a lot of money, although exactly where the money has gone is anybody's business. When we did the recut for Channel 4, Guccione's lawyers got on the phone and were saying, you do not have our permission to do this and blah, 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 blah. And it was, you know, so that it was that there was all that going on. But it has become a spectacular catastrophe that people are interested in the way that people are interested in Titanic, right. You know, not Titanic the film, Titanic the boat that sank. So yes, I think, I mean, look at the cast list. Peter O'Toole, John Gielgud, Malcolm McDowell, Helen Mirren, you know.
What were they thinking?
Well, what they were thinking was that they were making a different film. Helen Mirren once famously said, Caligula is a mess, but it has an irresistible mix of art and genitals in it, which is a very, very Helen Mirren thing to say. And so I'd be delighted. Anyway, the story that that John Gielgud tells about going to when Caligula finally opened in the US in its pornographic version, in the longest version, the Guccione version. And he told this story. He used to refer to it as my first pornographic feature, and which he used to love saying. So he went along to see it in New York. It was playing in this theater in New York. Well, you had to pay quite a big ticket price for it, and it was X-rated. And he said he stood in the queue, and he stood behind these two, what he referred to as old biddies, who he thought, you know, heaven's sake, what on earth are they doing here? You know, presumably they're here because it's Helen Mirren and John Gielgud and, you know, Peter O'Toole and all that stuff. So he said he just couldn't think what they were going to make of it. So he went into the cinema and he sat behind them watching the film. And the film starts and, you know, there's all this stuff and it's carnage and, you know, filth and stuff and, you know, bodily fluids and hardcore this, that and the other and bloody, bloody, blah. He said they sit there through and it's the long version, which is, you know, because this new version apparently is a 3-hour cut. So they sit through the whole thing. I mean, the version that I saw at the Prince Charles was pretty close to 3. It had an interval in it. And at the end of it, the film finishes and they get up and they start walking up the aisle and he walks up behind them and one of them turns to the other and says, well, that was worth every cent.
Really? Wow. Everything I ever learnt about Caligula was from John Hurt
in I Claudius.
In I Claudius, which was quite enough.
Yes.
I think, with Brian Blessed as Augustus. And Christopher Biggins as Nero.
No!
Yes, and now...
I don't remember that. Wow!
You say that, you think, Christopher Biggins as Nero? That's incredible. But that was another, wow. And a great cast. Derek Jacobi, of course.
Yeah. But no, I mean, I can't...
I hope that's a good enough answer for you, Charlie, in California.
I am across it, and I really want to see it. I mean, I really, really want to see it, because I have had, for ages, I was trying to make a documentary called O Caligula, as in, you know, up Pompeii, or, you know, or whatever it was, because, of course, the Italian time. Anyway, that obviously is never going to happen. We tried to sell it to Channel 4 for years and years and years, but it never happened. Malcolm McDowell talking about it is brilliant. The Malcolm McDowell commentary track is great. I cannot wait to see whether maybe this is the film that it could have been.
Helen in Pimlico, heritage listener, first time emergency mailer. Dear Sad Thing and Unfortunate Event, your recent discussion of things offspring have said that they want to inherit on their parents' passing.
Oh, yes.
Reminded me of an embarrassing childhood story of which my parents love to remind me. At the age of about 7 or 8, I was locked in a battle of wills with my mother to convince her to let me have a pet. Having been refused a proper animal, such as a cat or a dog, I set my sights on less ambitious targets, but even my pleas for a rabbit or a guinea pig fell on deaf ears. Eventually, in indignant fury, I shouted, "When you die, I'm going to get a rat," before storming out.
Oh, no.
Despite the 30 years have passed since this event, my parents have yet to tire of recounting it. I got a stick insect.
Did you?
Yeah, as a kid.
And?
I kept it in a jam jar and gave it privet.
Privet?
It only eats privet from a hedge.
Is that right?
Yeah.
It's also the one of the best Blackadder lines, isn't it? It's the stickiest situation since Sticky the stick insect got stuck on a sticky bun.
And I'm afraid to say that my Sticky the stick insect didn't last after our summer holiday, when I forgot to arrange for it to have lots of privet delivered. And so that was...
And you came back and it was just a stick.
It was, without the insect. Anyway, I confess.
That's kind of heartbreaking.
It is, really. Correspondence at kerbinamayor.com. Pretentious.
It took a dark turn.
Yes.
Can we go back to Caligula? It was much more fun.
Animals that have passed under my keeping. Right, pretentious moi. The pretentious bed.
Is it easy or difficult this week?
I've given up trying to work it out.
You don't care anymore, do you?
The keywords have been removed by the Windsor Protocol, Ursula von der Leyen, and Rishi Sunak.
So this is very topical.
Yes, that's right. So here we go. Mark, what is the film you're reviewing here? The Windsor Protocol immerses its audience in an unfolding road movie fable. While Rishi Sunak's script, on which author-producer Ursula von der Leyen shares a story credit, may veer occasionally into narrative contrivance, there's an emotional honesty to the central love story that rings true despite the odd note of implausibility. What is that film?
Do it once more.
The Windsor Protocol.
Is that the name of the film?
Yes. Immerses its audience in an unfolding road movie fable, while screenwriter Rishi Sunak's script, on which author-producer Ursula von der Leyen shares a story credit, may veer occasionally into narrative contrivance, there's an emotional honesty to the central love story that rings true, despite the odd note of implausibility.
I'll be honest, I have no idea. I mean, there's no solid objects or recognizable shapes for me to get a handle on. I have no idea what that is.
Nothing to work with, really.
Nothing to work
with. Okay, so here we go. I'll put in the answers.
Okay,
one by
do one by one, and then just okay. Okay, the first answer is the name of the film, isn't it?
Queen and Slim immerses its audience in an unfolding road movie fable.
Okay.
While Lena Waites' script, on which author-producer James Frey shares a story credit, may veer occasionally into narrative contrivance, there's an emotional honesty to the central love story that rings true despite the odd note of implausibility.
Okay, I mean, I agree with my review of that film, but I'm sorry, there was no definable shape, because, you know, I don't know when it is, because I've been writing for The Observer for, you know, however many years it is now, and many road movies with implausible elements. I need more land masses.
More land mass. Do you ever make more land mass, please?
Do you ever do that thing? You know, Wordle?
Yes.
There's a thing called Worldle. Right. Have you seen this?
No.
They show you the outline of a country.
Oh, I have heard right. about it, yes.
Okay, well, of course, I'm just a total disaster. The good lady professor, her indoors, is very good at it. She will see a shape and she'll go, well, that looks like, you know, an African territory or...
So many landlocked countries are very difficult to work out.
Right? So then you put in where you think it is and then it goes, you are... 15,000 miles wrong. Okay.
Yeah.
And then Linda goes, oh, okay, fine. Then that narrows it down. I go, that doesn't make any difference to me because there's nothing that I recognize. Yes. I don't know my way around the globe at all. Well, in terms of that, it's like, I'm sorry, I had no, it could have, I don't actually think it was pretentious either. I think it was
beautifully written.
No, I just think it was adequately written. It's a lovely film. You know, it's really, really tactile film, but I don't think it was particularly pretentious.
But it fitted the format and so therefore has been included.
Yes, maybe schools. The format should be retired.
Do you think?
Well, I think
I think it can be retired when you, well, as soon as you get in the lead, then we can stop. Okay. But you have to at least be equal.
Okay, but I need more shapes or it needs to be something that's more ripe, that's more overwritten. Because, okay. You know, it needs to fulfil the pretentious thing
so
as well as
the...
does
it need more landmass or more ripeness? It
needs both of those
a
things.
A ripe landmass.
Yes, because the question is, can I recognise what I was never knowingly underwritten me?
So anyway, yes, so correspondence at codamayor.com. You mentioned one frame back about fashion.
Fashion reimagined.
Fashion reimagined.
Yes.
So we've been asking our fantastic vanguardista... films that feature fashion, of which, of course, there are many.
Many, many, many.
Daniel Woodrow says,
I mean, arguably, all films feature fashion.
Michael Caine and William Shatner hamming it up to the high heavens in Miss Congeniality is one of my guilty pleasures. Sean says, it's terrible, but I love Pret-a-Porter.
No, it's terrible.
It's no Nashville, but it just feels like a time capsule for a very specific period. After that, the twins, Phantom Thread, and Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris.
Yeah.
Joe Smith, it's Phantom Thread / In Fabric double bill for me. Also, boom. Zoolander is a must.
Yeah.
Carrie Morrison, you cannot talk about fashion and not talk about Devil Wears Prada, a stellar cast containing one of Meryl Streep's best performances. Paul says the documentary McQueen. Lisa Newman goes for Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris. Jenny Bevan did a fantastic job recreating the gorgeous Dior dresses. Pat's Beitastin. Thank you, Pat's. Cruella, with Mark's favourite, Emma Thompson. The fashion pieces were inspiring and integral within the movie, I thought. Integral within the movie. And Will Buckner, Peter Strickland's In Fabric is one way his fashion-orientated remake of Black Beauty is in one way a fashion-orientated remake of Black Beauty, but using a killer dress instead of a horse.
And taking inspiration from I'm Deadly Tonight. Was it I'm Dangerous Tonight? I'm Deadly Tonight. One of those two.
What are you going to focus your fashion feature favoritivity on?
From which film does this line come? Please recite for me the numbers of your telephone.
Is it Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy?
No, it's one of the ones that in this thing. Please recite for me the numbers of your telephone.
Zoolander.
No.
Pret-a-Porter.
No.
McQueen. Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris.
Keep going.
In Fabric.
Yes, well done. It's great the way you can immediately recognise a piece of Strickland dialogue. No, but I did review it.
Yeah, but how long ago did you review it?
Well, when it came out, which was a few years ago.
Exactly. I can't remember.
You don't care. Peter Strickland's next film is... Flux Gourmet, which I did review when it came out, which includes the line, you can keep the Epicurean toxicity, but humour me on the flanger.
And at that point, we conclude this episode, because that's, where do you go from there?
Where do you go from there?
It isn't possible.
Downhill.
Get in touch. We'd love to hear from you for some of our takes, which are on the way. So get in touch, correspondence at CurbanAmeo.com. Questions, schmestions in take 3. We'll be with you in just a few days' time. Patience is everything.